Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. We are going to wait for a few minutes for the first bill on the agenda, Senate Bill 1514, so Senator Bates can be here. And then we're going to start out by opening another public hearing on Senate Bill 1530.
I do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Mike Salvaggio, Business Oregon. John Saris is here. Doug Riggs, I think, is here. Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to see. I know. I'm just trying to see who else is here. Mostly Paul, John, Mike.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Paul, John, Mingo, and George.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have Senate Bill 1530. We talked at your first hearing about a Dash 2 amendment, and now you actually have it, and that should be in your packet. What that amendment does, a couple of things. There was some language talking about increased revenue, and what the amendment does is change that to exceeds the baseline amount. As you recall, what the Department of Revenue would be doing in terms of its performance contract negotiations, it would be establishing a baseline amount, and then the revenue above that baseline would go into this technology account, the Revenue Technology Modernization Fund that's established in the bill. The baseline, if you look at the language in Section 2 of the Dash 2, it has the department setting the baseline after consultation with the Legislative Revenue Office in order to establish a baseline, which, of course, would be a very key element in the negotiation process. The other couple of other things that the amendment does is it takes out the expenditure limitation because there is no direct expenditure to the fund. And, of course, the fund itself would be established by this bill, but there would be no revenue flowing to it until there's funding for the project from the Ways and Means Committee. And given the fact that the project has been put on hold until funding in the 2013 session is discussed, the emergency clause was removed, too, from the original committee bill. So those are the Dash 2 amendments. You have a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 2 from LFO, and you have a measure summary. There isn't any direct revenue impact from the measure, from just setting up this fund. And once it was set up, what the revenue impact would be the dollars flowing into the fund as a result of the project. There's also some, you had asked some questions of the Department of Revenue, and that's in your packet as well. There's a one-pager from Director Karen Gregory addressing some questions you asked. One specifically, Senator Telfer asked about the Government Accounting Standards Board, GASB 54, restricted and unrestricted funds. And then also some answering the question Senator Morse raised about the cost to purchase a new system outright. And we also have the Department, Eric Smith is here to answer any questions that the committee has.
Okay, I think we have somebody here from SEIU. I think we might bring them up first and then get down to some of the questions that Senator Morris and actually the rest of us have about the funding mechanism after that testimony. So we'll start out with Stacy Cowan from SEIU.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Stacy Cowan. I'm with SEIU. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak this morning. Just a couple of quick comments. We really just wanted an opportunity to get a couple of concerns on the record about Senate Bill 1530, and it's mostly just in regards to legislative oversight. We really would like to see significantly more oversight when it comes to setting the baseline. The baseline is going to be used to determine whether or not this program is successful. It's also going to be used to determine the percentage that the contractors are going to be paid. We really just wanted to highlight that through this process, we really would like to see a significant level of legislative oversight during that. We'd like to see more legislative oversight, again, on how much and what percentage the contractor is going to get paid, specifically whether or not there's a cap on payments that the contractor is going to be able to receive. It's my understanding that there is no cap on those payments that the contractor might be able to receive. The bill just raises some questions for us. One of those would be, what happens if the program is not successful? What percentage will the contractor be receiving, and where will that money come from? The bill addresses really just what happens in the if there is an increase in funds, but we'd like to see some conversation maybe about what happens if the program replacement isn't successful. Really, that's most of our concerns. We just think that it's essential to have a tremendous amount of transparency and legislative oversight when moving forward with such a costly and a large program replacement. So that's all the comments I have this morning. Thank you.
Some of these issues, in fact, probably most of them that you've raised, are issues that we are very concerned about. So I appreciate you starting us out. I hope the Revenue Department was taking notes with those questions, because they are very on point. Are there questions of this witness from the committee? Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay. Now we'll bring the Department of Revenue up.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith, and I'm the manager of the Program Management Office at the Department of Revenue. Would you like me to address the questions that were just asked? Or?
Yes, that would be a good start. We're concerned about how the baseline is set. Obviously, the witness said that we need more legislative oversight, but I'd like to find out what systems are in place in Department of Revenue to do that, whether or not there's a cap on payments, and what happens if the system fails. And then you can add one more question, which is, what is the risk of not passing legislation at this point instead of waiting?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Beginning with the first question, how the baselines are established, we have looked at the income tax enforcement programs that include non-filer enforcement, refund fraud, and then the audit and collection activities of the agencies, the areas that are going to be most suitable for trying to establish baselines that will give us an indication of how a new system, which is just a part of it, it's the new system and then us improving our business practices to take advantage of the new technology, will enable us to generate the enforcement revenue that would go into this fund over the baselines. And so we've looked at the last several years of our performance in those areas, and we're in the process. In fact, the vendors in town today, this week, of actually negotiating what those baselines will look like. The substantial baseline will be the collection of our accounts receivable. That'll be the primary baseline. That will be the most significant baseline that we'll be tracking. Historically, how have we done with that? And we'll want to document that. We'll have that in the contract. And as we testified, I think last month at the General Government Ways and Means Subcommittee, there's an expectation that once we've negotiated the contract, we'll come back during the interim and report to the legislative body. I'm not sure if that will be through the emergency board. But we will disclose what those baselines are, what the terms of the contract are, what the costs of the contract will be, and what we anticipate the department's expenses to be. So we do intend to be completely transparent about all of that. In Senate Bill 1530, the consulting legislative revenue office is the language that we had in there. A member from our department has been in regular contact with legislative revenue office just to talk about the concepts as we head into conceptually how we want to establish these baselines, and we expect them to have a review before we even sign the contract of what those baselines will look like as well. So that was a high-level overview of the baselines, Madam Chair.
The committee members might want to go into more depth, but why don't you cover the other points, and then we'll open it to questions.
With regard to how much the contractor is paid, we have intended all along that this would be a fixed-price agreement, which means there will be a cap. The bids that we received were fixed-price agreements, and when we negotiate the contract, there will be a price not to exceed that the vendor would be compensated for. And so it is not, there is a cap. It's not true that there is no cap. With regard to what happens if the program is not successful, the advantage that the state of Oregon has by entering into a benefits-based agreement is it's a performance-based contract. We will set milestones throughout the life of the contract for the different deliverables that the contractor needs to meet, and then we'll monitor what happens to those baselines. For example, after you implement personal income tax program collection and audit and other functions, are we achieving the revenue over baseline that we anticipated? If we don't achieve those revenues over the baseline, there won't be money in the fund to pay the vendor. And so that is what would happen if there would not be a successful implementation. The vendor bears the risk of not getting paid. And the vendors in this workspace, in particular this vendor, is very confident that based on their experience in many other states, the improvements we'll be able to make to our business processes and the technology that they're going to afford us will allow us to be successful. That's why they're willing to take the risk of putting their money up front, investing in the systems, and then monitoring that the benefit over the baselines to get paid from out of that over the next 5 years.
In the other states that they've worked in, have they always used the same payment mechanism, the benefit-based contract?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no. But the most recent contract in California they did do, and they did it in California for their payroll withholding tax. I believe the price for that contract was $75 million. And within the first 18 months, they realized the $75 million over the baseline they established, and after 24 months, they had $150 million in the state of California. So they do have experience doing it, but it's not common for them.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead. What else did we have you talking on here?
I believe there was one more question you asked.
Oh, the risk of not passing it now.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the benefit of passing Senate Bill 1530 now, as I said earlier, we are, over the next 4 weeks, in negotiations with the vendor. And if we had the funding mechanism in place, in law, it gives us, I think, a better position to negotiate from. The vendor will understand that the state is serious about this and that the only thing left to do would be to go through the interim process of sharing with you what the details of the contract are and then going through the budget process for the department in the 2013 legislature, where we would then ask for other funds limitation to then put into the, you know, as the revenues over baselines are realized, that we would have the ability to take those funds that are in the fund and pay for vendor expenses and the department's expenses. So having the mechanism now gives us, I think, a stronger negotiating position with the vendor because we can describe in great detail how they'll be paid.
If we did put this payment mechanism in place, is there anything that would prevent us from switching to a direct payment farther down the road?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I anticipated that question after the questions about benefits-based funding, and I spoke with one of our attorneys who's helped us with the procurement process. Though there are possibilities for how we could look at how we would change the procurement process, there would be a lot of effort about that, and it would include the other vendors who have already bid on this, and we've selected this vendor in a benefits-based procurement process, and so it could get complicated. This was not a procurement process that allowed the vendors to bid on an outright purchase. We asked them for a benefits-based price, and so they included that in that their cost of capital, any risk premium, and anything else that they felt that they would need to cover as they fronted the state and put the system in and got paid after the system was in.
And I think I actually asked the question at our last hearing, is to get some kind of a comparison, mm-hmm, of how much we pay under the benefits-based system versus how much, like just in raw dollars.
Yes.
Get some kind of a comparison of how much of a premium we are paying for that risk and the front-end loading of it.
Yes, Madam Chair, and in my response to the Legislative Revenue Office, the vendor was very open to share with us what they believed it would be, though they said it was difficult without doing an actual bid on outright procurement. They said Oregon is probably paying over the life of the contract about $5 to $10 million more for the risk premium, their cost of carrying capital. But they also disclosed that they know a lot more about the state now, and I'm sure that part of this was a sales pitch, but they said Oregon, we're more sophisticated at the Department of Revenue than they anticipated in terms of how integrated our systems are. And they said if they had to rebid for an outright procurement, it may be a little bit more than they bid with the initial price for the benefits base. So even though based on their initial bid, they said $5 to $10 million, they said if you were to change it, there's no guarantee that that's what it would be. And, of course, time changes. If we had to do a new procurement process, the circumstances for that business and our circumstances would be different. It would be a brand-new bid more likely.
Okay, let me make sure I understand you. They're saying that under the assumption that they were making when they first bid, that the benefits base would be about $5 to $10 million more.
Correct.
But now, because they feel that they underbid on the benefits base?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they've implied that. They just wanted us to be cautious, that if we thought that we could just take $5 to $10 million off their bid, that to get a bid for an outright procurement, it may not be apples to apples. And I respect that they were genuine in telling us that, yes.
Okay. And then do you have any sense of the other states that don't do the benefits-based contracts? I mean, because pretty much all states are in kind of the same soup we're in terms mm-hmm. of budgets. Do you have any sense of how they paid for them?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, a number of these states, and particularly with this vendor, they began really installing in a lot of states in 2000 and in the early 2000s. And so many of the states were able to, in 2004, 5, and 6, like Utah and Montana, they actually did do outright purchases and procurements. So they, with this vendor anyway, they were not doing benefits-based contracts. But more recently, there are more. I know the state of Iowa is looking at doing a benefits-based procurement right now. And so there are...
Iowa,
correct.
And what is the cap? You said we have a cap. What is the cap?
Well, in the business case that we've prepared, now we have not negotiated what the final price is, but the business case that we've prepared, the range not to exceed for the vendor is $68 million. And so they gave us a bid for the base price of what we asked for in our statement of work to meet our business requirements, but we also asked all vendors to provide for us, are there any value-added items that we may have missed in our statement of work? And so there are, I believe, 8 or 9 value-added items that if we were to look at in the next 2 or 3 years, taking advantage of those to further improve our compliance efforts, that would, if you were to implement all of those, the total price that they quoted us was $68 million. But of course, that all needs to be negotiated still this week. But that would be the highest price that the state would pay for their system.
And if it didn't yield, that much, that good of a result over the baseline, then they could get considerably less.
Correct.
But under no circumstance, even with all the bells and whistles, would they get more than $68 million?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Other questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's go back to the original decision to exclude a purchase, whether a benefit purchase. Why are we going down this road, and why didn't we run 2 parallel paths?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, when we were beginning our procurement process about 18 months ago, I was not a part of those conversations, but I've asked, and what I understood we were told is that there will not be any additional revenue for an outright procurement, so don't even bother trying to do that. The only way that we would be able to pay for this is if it could be, quote, self-funded, unquote. And there was an awareness of this benefits-based process, and so we were encouraged to proceed with that. And our director at that time, Elizabeth Harshenko, made the decision that that was the path we would take. And there's a fair amount of effort, both for the state and for the vendor, to do procurement processes. So part of it may have been a cost savings decision. decision on our side for us and the vendor. But apparently it was signaled pretty clearly that that was the only way the department would probably be successful, is to have it, quote, self-funded or through a benefits-based project.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I won't take issue with the department's response to the direction from the legislature, but I do take extreme difference of opinion with respect to financing, how to finance a basic core function of government in this manner without having, you know, a better vetting and understanding of this whole issue. If we are, as I said earlier, if we are so broke in state government that we cannot fund up to the $60 or $70 million, which is just, I mean, those are core functions. If we can't do that, we're in trouble. And I'd go back and press that issue. I just don't.
Well, that is true, but there's another side to it, Senator Morse, and that is the risk factor. We've had so many nightmares with computer systems all over the state, at the local government and state government, and this does have that one advantage over a direct appropriation. If you make a direct appropriation and the system fails, you're out of luck. And with this mechanism, that you get that benefit from it. I certainly agree with you on principle that this is a core function.
If it's the same contractor, Madam Chair, that's doing, you know, both, I just, sure, you might transfer a little more risk to them, but they do have a track record. You mentioned that there are other states that have made outright purchases. I'd be interested to know what the success was. I also believe that there was a consulting component to their services. I'm just not comfortable with this approach without further vetting.
Other questions?
I have some questions, not in regards to what Senator Morris just said. New question. Okay. And while I agree with Senator Morris, I appreciate your response to the GASB 54 question that I had. I do need to correct your statement. It's correct, but let me give you the in between that you're not saying. GASB 54. Does use restricted and unrestricted. It just doesn't use reserved and unreserved anymore. But under the unrestricted, is committed and assigned and unassigned. So the way you've worded it, it looks like committed is, you know, once the money's spent, you know, we're done. There's no more. But committed means that the legislature has allowed somebody to go ahead and spend money in a designated manner. The legislature can redeploy those dollars if they so choose. It's not statutorily restricted. It's not constitutionally restricted. So it is unrestricted. It's just committed or designated for a purpose. But again, the next legislative gathering could change that. So a little caution there, and not that we would, but we could. And that they still are unrestricted funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the world that these vendors live in, dealing with government entities, and this particular vendor, to Senator Morse's point, has been successful in 16 states. They're 16 for 16 for on time and on budget. Even with an outright procurement in a project that spreads over 4 or 5 years, you begin on a project that you need an appropriation for in the next biennium, and you can't commit a future legislative body for that. And so they're used to dealing with that, and they've had to deal with the risks that are inherent with trying to be funded through the budget process and two-year budget cycles, whether it's an outright procurement. And I'm sure they're aware of the risks that could exist, as you described, Senator Telfer, as well.
But there is a contract, right? I mean, the state signs a contract, so that would help to...
But if I may, that we've signed the contract, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to fund this to pay for that contract. We've set up a shell with this piece of if we pass this
right.
piece of legislation, we've set up the shell.
Right.
If we never fund it, really.
But they fund it. That's how it works. They fund it, and then we have a contract to pay them back, right?
Madam Chair, yes, we will. The state will have a contract to pay them, and if depending on why there are no funds in the account, determines on how that would play out if the state couldn't pay them.
Yeah, contract law is pretty strong in Oregon.
Well, it depends on what's in the contract. What I'm just saying is that these dollars are unrestricted dollars. They may be committed, but they're still unrestricted. And at the whim of the legislature, we have we're doing more than just a shell, because if we do the shell and you sign a contract, then we're done. And so I have some real heartburn on this method of financing. I just can't believe that we're going to spend 15%+ because of a risk factor that is, in my mind, not as risky as one might think. And if we want to call it the cost of capital, because they're funding the money, that could be expensive capital. Not that we're going to borrow the money or anything like that necessarily, but...
Receivables factoring is the highest cost.
Yeah, that's
money.
Really right.
And that's really what we're talking about, Madam Chair. Excuse me for interrupting.
Yeah. No, and I think the real weighing here is what we don't have the money to actually fund it. So the issue is whether we do something like this or don't do anything.
Or we can renegotiate, or when we negotiate, how much. The $5-10 million, you know, maybe we can look at that. This is a major decision when it's a vehicle that I know two of us don't necessarily support the vehicle. And when I get answers that are like this, then I question some of the other things, frankly, in the decision making process. So.
Madam Chair, in the interest of moving this discussion along, I'm firmly committed and believe that we need the upgrades. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. It becomes a function of how. And I see that legislative revenue is recommending a referral to Ways and Means. I would be willing to make that referral on the basis of having two parallel analyses. One is an outright purchase, and the other is a benefit-based contract purchase. And if it means delaying the process for a few months, that's a very small issue in order to understand what really is the best way to finance this project. And further, that with such a motion would be a letter to legislative fiscal that we should re-examine the sources of capital to make a purchase rather than having a benefits-based purchase, to re-examine that. The budgeting decision really isn't ours. We're creating the vehicle, but I'm not ready to cast this loose and say this is the right way and the right approach.
Can we point to some other states who have hit a home run with this? Maybe I missed some of that last week, but if we could, I think that'd be helpful to see how they did it.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, that home run in regards to being successful with the benefits-based funding. Mm-hmm. With the current vendor that we have, I articulated about California this morning. That's the most current experience where they were able to recover the cost for the system in 18 months of $75 million. And then after 24 months, they had achieved $150 million over their baselines that they had established. With this vendor, I don't know of any other benefits-based contracts that are far enough along to talk about results. I know they're looking at entering those.
But this vendor wasn't California.
was in California.
It was in California. Yes. Okay, I missed that.
Well, dealing with California as a CPA, I can tell you their baseline is probably pretty low, so it wouldn't take much to improve upon their system down there.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I don't know the details of the baseline that they developed, but I do know that it was actually negotiated to be a fairly difficult baseline for them to achieve, and they still achieved it. And I can get more detail about that if that would be helpful, and compare that to the baselines that we're doing. They'll be different because, again, that was for their withholding and payroll tax program only, and they had to back out of that, the federal receipts that come with that, because they weren't eligible to be in the pot to pay for the vendor. So it was a bit more complicated than the accounts receivable collections we're trying to do. But I'd be happy to find out more about that if you'd like to know.
Yeah, if I may, you had mentioned there were five other states that are using this company, this vendor. And can you tell us how successful those other states have been?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfler, they have been in, I believe, 16 other departments of revenue around the United States since 2000. Okay. 16, and they've also been in Canada and in some municipal governments. So they have 24 areas that they've put their new systems in, and with all 24, they've been on time and on budget. They're a niche company. They are very focused on exactly the kind of work we do. They don't do anything else other than that, and they become very specialized in what they're doing, and that's one reason why they're very successful at what they're doing.
Okay. okay, we're going to close the... do you have anything else you wanted to add based on the conversation?
Madam Chair, no. Thank you.
We're going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 1530, and we're going to... Some magic is going to occur, and we're going to figure out a path for this. I think there's a strong sense on the committee that we need to do something, and it's all in, you know, how we do it and what kind of analysis we need. So we'll probably be contacting you for some technical guidance on this. Okay, we will not be talking about Senate Bill 1514 today. That will may or may not come back on another day. And so now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1558.
Sure.
Go sit in the hot seat. Good morning, Madison.
Morning, Chair Riddick, members of the committee. This is part of the debt and borrowing section of my portfolio. And the bill in front of you, 1558, Senate Bill 1558, also has a dash one in front of you. This is the amendment that seems to work some of the issues that used to be with the main bill. The bill primarily is about revenue bonds, conduit bonds, and these are through the Oregon Business Development Commission and Department. And those bonds are supposed or suggested in the bill of different in the their treatment in the dash one amendment. The dash one amendment fixes a few things, mainly the idea of the operating capital. This you would find was proposed to be a three-year estimate for the operating expenses to be paid out of the bond proceeds, and that is no longer the case in the Dash 1 amendment. And also, the Dash 1 amendment designs the these proceeds and these bonds to primarily be in the substantial benefit in Oregon, so this would not be a bond issuance that will end up in benefit somewhere else. these are the highlights of the little and the dash one number.
Okie dokie. We are honored with the presence on the other side of the dais with Senator Telfer. Now we've gotten warmed up, so we'll be able to come at you with hard questions.
Yeah. So. I'm ready. I'm going now.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Chris Telfer, Senator from sunny Central Oregon. And I might add that you all look fine up there. I mean, you know, names are spelled correctly. I've not seen you from this side. Senate Bill 1558. Currently, industrial revenue bonds in the state of Oregon and most states, other than maybe five, allow for the proceeds to be used to purchase buildings, acquire buildings, and fixed assets, equipment. Not a lot of job creation in those endeavors. What 1558 does is it broadens the scope of the use of those funds to include research and development and operating expenses for capital asset. The catalyst for this bill came from a company that contacted me, as well as Economic Development Central Oregon, that would like to move to Central Oregon. With it would be the creation of about 1,000 jobs, which is $32 million in Central Oregon, which has probably the highest, if not one of the highest, along with Crook County, of unemployment in the state. This bill, this expansion of the use of the proceeds for industrial revenue bonds, though, would apply to any area of the state. This was merely the catalyst of wanting to change the use of our proceeds. We are in competition with four other states in Washington, D.C. to acquire this business in Oregon. Without this bill, they will not move to Oregon. With this bill, we do open the gate for consideration, and we are high on their list. I can tell you they like the labor market in that area as well as Oregon. So we're high on the list. And the other thing I want to note is that these bonds are not state money. As Mazin said, these are a conduit. The reason people like these bonds is they're really kind of overseen by the federal government regulations. But the reason people like these bonds is, frankly, there's just another set of eyes that vet the project, and that being the state of Oregon, with Business Oregon being the one that vets it and kind of looks at the and then approves the project and the use of the proceeds. So there are a lot of sideboards within Business Oregon also in vetting this. So key is no state money. These are non-recourse loans through the issuer of the bond, which is the company, and the bondholders, which are private individuals or entities. This is private money. The Dash 1, the main thing the Dash 1 does is puts another sideboard on the fact that the use of these proceeds are to be done in the state of Oregon, not to, you know, go to another state. So while the company belongs or is located in Oregon, the money also need to be spent in within the state and not another state where they have another division. I might add that this company, I've been on a lot of communication with the president and CEO, kind of an ongoing communication. He's very excited. I believe they're willing to even work with Business Oregon now to start the ball rolling on some initial things. I don't know if you can ask Business Oregon, who's going to testify in a bit, if they have communicated with them. But so with that, I will close my testimony. I do know we have the treasurer's office here. I might add that this bill was drafted sitting around the table. I brought in our bond counsel, the treasurer's office, the Business Oregon, Department of Justice was there, legislative counsel was there. I think the governor's office that was there. I have been in contact with the governor's office on this. So we pretty much got everybody around the table and drafted the legislation. So if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them, or let Business Oregon, the treasurer's office, and some other individuals answer specific questions.
Okay. I've already heard some of this on my other committee. This is a subsequent referral from the Business Economic and Transportation and Economic Development Committee. So are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Does anybody from Business Oregon and the Treasurer want to come up? You're not signed up, but you don't have to come unless... What? Be there for answer questions, okay? We have signed up Doug Riggs and Jody Weiser.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. So we represent the nine cities in Crook, Jefferson, and Deschutes counties. And we've been following this very closely, so we really appreciate taking time to see it. As the chair mentioned, this is a bill that came from the Business and Labor Committee, and we had quite a bit of testimony in that committee, and we can provide that testimony if you'd like. I just want to make a few points, one to echo Senator Telfer's point, which is, like many areas of the state, our area has been hard hit by the economic recession. Unemployment in all three counties have been well above 12% pretty consistently. Functional unemployment in Crook County about 6 months ago, I heard, was over 25%. So lots of folks have stopped looking for a job. So clearly we have an immediate need to do something. We hear an awful lot that one bill or another is a tool in the toolkit. And I think that's an apt description for a lot of the bills. I think this isn't just a tool. I think this may be the tool in the toolkit for this particular issue, and it might help incentivize some other economic development elsewhere. We're talking about the potential in this particular case of well over 1,000 jobs eventually. If you include all the ancillary jobs that will be created in the construction industry, the retail industry, et cetera. And so that's jobs for families. That's economic development for the region. That's tax revenue for state, county, and local governments that help schools, help human services, et cetera. So this clearly is offers a lot of potential. One change in the Dash Ones, as Mazen pointed out, is a change that focuses this on Oregon projects. We think that's very important. And there are a couple other technical changes. I understand that both the Business Oregon Department and the Treasurer's Office is here or are here today and be able to fill you in. So again, on behalf of the people of Central Oregon, we thank Senator Telfer for bringing us through the process. I'm happy to answer any questions, and we strongly support this bill.
Okay. Jody?
I'm Jody Weiser with Taxpayers Oregon. We are concerned about this bill because we're afraid that we are leading potential bond buyers astray. When people think of government bonds, they think of it as a fairly secure investment, and research and development and working capital are actually venture capital kinds of investments for which companies usually give up equity or pay high interest. They'll probably be classified that way, but there's an experienced bond buyer who would be making the original investment, but then his plan is to resell them in the market, and it's that point that we're concerned about. This is possible in some other states, but I'm not sure that we've done a survey to see what their experience has been. And I found something that talked about how many revenue bonds a year we sold in 1998. And I wonder if all 80 million that this bond buyer is interested in investing would be sold right away, if that would use up too much of our capacity for revenue bonds, and then we wouldn't have it available for other businesses. So that would be a question to explore. It's a bit scary that we could be known if it doesn't work. This is a small company with like 11 employees that are hoping that their idea will make it big, and it would be great for Oregon if it did. But if a bond has our good housekeeping seal of approval on it, and it goes out the door that way and they fail, then it could make Oregon look like a state you don't want to buy bonds from. And we sell bonds for many other purposes than just these kind of revenue bonds for kind of risky investments. So for sure, if you go forward, we would propose that you say, this is for one company, we're going to see how it works, or we're going to do it for this time period and do a study to see how it works, because we have a responsibility to consumers as well as to businesses, and we need to be sure that we're doing something for the long term that is good. We didn't have time to investigate the states that have opened their bonding authority up this way. We understand that Washington, D.C. opened theirs up for this same business, so they wouldn't have any experience with what it's like once they've done this.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, I do have a question. Maybe it's more appropriate for the Treasury.
We're going to bring the bond people up.
Okay. I'll hold the question. Thank you.
Just comment, Jody's comments are well received. I have talked to their bond counsel as well as our people regarding industrial revenue bonds, and apparently there is a purchaser for this $80 million, but there are apparently a number of portfolios that like industrial revenue bonds. And again, I have faith in our Business Oregon as far as the sideboards and vetting this and deciding whether this is, in fact, a good project. I mean, I don't think our Business Oregon goes out and willy-nilly approves projects that are going to fail. But again, as any bondholder of any bond, it's up to the bondholder to look at the prospectus and make their own judgment on whether this is a... you know, it's like buying a share of stock. I mean, you do your own research. We can't be too much of a nanny state. We can't hold every bondholder's hand. But again, I have confidence in Oregon's ability to vet this and oversee the project and make sure that it's a good project to begin with. But I think bond counsel, as far as our debt capacity, et cetera, can probably respond to that concern.
Well, I asked... an investment advisor that buys bonds for his clients, right? And he said, well, bonds can be safe or they can be risky. They're all types. Junk bonds, for instance, can be very risky if one's buying at the lowest ratings. In the end, bond buyers will decide if they like or don't like the merits of these bonds. If investors deem them too high risk, they'll stay away. But on the other hand, he said that it sounds very dicey to him and not what he would expect revenue bonds from a state to be selling. It's just a change that he wouldn't expect.
Madam Chair, could I ask if he's dealt with an industrial revenue bond? These are different. This is private equity.
No,
so
yeah,
he has dealt with industrial revenue. Mm-hmm. He says they're dicey?
He says for what he expects the revenue bond to be, this is dicey, because there's no building to back up the bond. There's no, you know, if you're doing research and development, There's less safety there for the bond buyer, and he's used to industrial revenue bonds, meaning that it's backed up by capital assets, and these wouldn't be. Uh-huh. And obviously, in reading the prospectus, you would see that, but you'd have to be sure that people are going to read the prospectus.
Yeah, that's a good point. I do believe the federal government puts some caps on how much of this money can be in R&D and how much can be working capital and how much can be, you know, fixed assets. So appreciate
and
that.
And it's not it says 3 years of...
No, that's been deleted.
Oh, that
the
has
cap,
been deleted.
The cap comes from the federal government more.
Oh, good.
So we don't need a cap then in the state?
A percentage of... I don't believe so. We can check with Mike.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, if I could just make a couple comments. First of all, I have faith that if someone wants to invest through the purchase of revenue bonds, industrial revenue bonds in Oregon, that they will have done their due diligence, especially at these levels. If they haven't, I would be surprised. I mean, certainly investments are risky in general, but I have confidence that whoever is interested is going to do their due diligence and probably is much more familiar with this project than we are. The second thing I'd say is that, as I understand it, you might want to ask the department. The commission will review any application for a revenue bond under this particular provision. So I would clarify that with the department. But, you know, I also have faith that the commission is not going to go willy-nilly and start issuing industrial revenue bonds in cases that don't make sense. So I believe that there are safeguards in this particular program. So
okay. That helps. Thank you. Okay, let's bring up the bond people in Business Oregon. Bonds and business. Come forward. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Silvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I volunteer to go first because my testimony on this will frankly be the most topical. Business Oregon is going to be running the nuts and bolts of it, but I'm pleased to convey the Treasury's support of the bill as amended with the Dash 1 amendments. We believe that it, the Dash 1 amendments give the proper oversight and review as was previously described to this process. Though the state is not putting actual money at risk, we do have our imprimatur on these bonds, and we feel that the Dash 1s give an appropriate screen for that. And furthermore, we feel that the adding this level of flexibility to the industrial revenue bond options is a appropriate way to add another mechanism by which we can leverage our existing resources into that metaphorical box where our mechanisms reside. So,
bonds issued under for the industrial revenue bonds, those don't go against our bond ceiling, do they?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, no, they do not. These bonds are conduit bonds. They're ultimately not an obligation of the state and therefore do not affect our capacity.
I think that there was some confusion around that. If relative to the suggestion that this be kind of a pilot program or have some limitation on it, if there were to be a sunset on this provision, what would be a reasonable period of time where you could make an assessment as to whether this works or not? I'm not saying we're committing to that, but just if we were to do that, what would be a reasonable time where you could see the effects of it but still have that kind of safety valve?
Chair Burbank, members of the committee, I think I'm going to defer most of this question to my colleagues in Business Oregon, but I think that is going to depend in large part on what the term of these bonds is going to look like, what types of projects, if it's something that is anticipated to essentially pay off rather quickly, then that's one thing. If it's something that's a more long-term process that may consist of a long commercialization to market process, and that's another thing altogether. But I'm going to use that opportunity to segue into Business Oregon's testimony.
Okay.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Business Development Department. I appreciate the opportunity today to talk a bit about Senate Bill 1558. And really briefly, before I get to your question, Senator Burdick, I want to note that this bill and the Dash 1s in particular were arrived at, as Senator Telfer and others have noted, with a great deal of thought. It was a very deliberative process with bond counsel, the treasurer's office, the senator's office, and others, and went through a lot of vetting through the process. So we're very appreciative of that, and to have the discussion for this limited allowable use. Specific to your question with respect to the sunset, and I'm very fortunate to have John Saris here with me today, who manages this program. I think, to echo Mike's comments, it's very difficult to put, I think, a firm number on it at this point, just recognizing the nature of the activity. Projects differ in size and scope, and there has to be an element of, I think, flexibility inherent in the program to recognize the types of activities that we're talking about. With the Dash 1 amendments, we're quite comfortable that we have achieved a sufficient level of oversight through our finance committee, who reviews and approves these bonds, and then still have a level of flexibility to capitalize on opportunities as they present themselves. But again, specific to your question, I am hesitant to give a firm number with respect to a sunset. John, who's much more well-versed with respect to the program, might have some other thoughts on that. But with that, I'll defer to John.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. I think some things to consider, if you were going to look at a potential sunset, would be the transaction history associated with the program. This is not a very high transaction-oriented type of a program, so actually getting out there and getting a sample size may be somewhat problematic. We're typically looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 5 transactions a year. And so, you know, just trying to set a sunset date, you may or may not get a set of projects that are put forward that actually would use or implement some of these provisions that are allowed for in Senate Bill 1558. So that's not a very clear answer.
What kind of reporting, in other words, how can you, once the bonds are issued, is there any mechanism in place for people to kind of keep an eye on it or find out how the progress is going on these bonds? In other words, we're just trying to, we've been burned so badly, especially on this committee, with things that just look great, and then you go down the road a little bit and you've got a major train wreck. And so what we like always to see is to be able to have an early identification if there is a problem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, once a bond is issued and those bonds are sold out into the public, there is really is not any ongoing due diligence that the state performs on a financial review, if you will, of the companies. We are made aware there are some reports that the companies do provide on an annual basis so that we can report to the United States Securities and Exchange Commission on the activity associated with the bonds that was issued, but it is not what I would call a full in-depth review of the financial health or viability of the company that did receive the bonds. That due diligence is still going to be retained with the purchasers of the bonds or the issuers of the letter of credit or the lenders that have provided the pass-through financing.
Okay. And then if there is kind of a worst case and the bonds end up being riskier than we thought they were going to be, and so they get kind of a bad image out there in the bond market. What are the consequences of that? Maybe that's a Michael question.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, as I mentioned before, these bonds would carry the imprimatur of the state's approval. The lending community in general, I hesitate to answer definitively because the rating process for our borrowing is a very long, complex process that happens at a pay grade far, far above mine. However, I will say that it is my understanding that the people at that level of pay understand the difference between a conduit bond and the state's general obligation, and that although, and John is going to hit me if I say anything in error, but although that may make the industrial revenue bond process a little rockier moving forward, if the state garners a reputation for having a pattern of that. That, in my understanding, is not going to be a strike against our general obligation rating. I think if that's what you're getting at.
That was the main thing, but just any other consequences that we might not have thought of?
Madam Chair, as people have testified earlier, the buyers of these bonds do some due diligence, and there is a risk rating associated with these bonds when they are marketed or remarketed. I think that part of our job at the state and at the department will be just to make sure that projects do meet eligibility requirements and do appear to be feasible. We do have a finance committee that consists of a number of lenders, CPAs, and industry leaders that actually review these credits in the process, and that's not to say that every transaction that we do is successful 100% of the time, but at the same time, they're familiar with what they're looking at, and they do have a good understanding of what the risks may be associated with the project that is issued.
Okay. And is anybody familiar with the sideboards that the feds put on these, the percentages that can be used for R&D and for operating?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the federal limitations associated with industrial revenue development bonds is what they call a de minimis, and it specifically only applies to the tax-exempt portion of the bonds. Basically, it is a limitation of, I believe, 2% currently. There are, I think, as we would look to evaluate projects that would come forward that would not use necessarily the federally tax-exempt portion of a bond that's issued, what's called a taxable tail would be used. I think that the Finance Committee and the lenders involved would make sure that the working capital or R&D is properly secured or enhanced by a letter of credit or other form of insurance to help safeguard the buyers of the bonds.
Is there something needed in the bill to put those kinds of sideboards on?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that every project comes forward with its own merits, and so I think one of the things that we evaluated with it is what are those risks and what is a viable project. And, you know, a company may be able to put forward a bond that would potentially be 100% working capital or R&D related, but they are very well secured or secured by strong secondary or tertiary assets. So, you know, I think that we would like to take a look at applications as they come forward and make sure that they do appear to be viable and secured properly.
Okay. Another question? Thank you. It's been very helpful. Anybody else out there have an opinion, comment on this? All right. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1558. We don't have the paperwork on the Dash 1 amendment yet, so we will carry this bill over until Wednesday. And I do believe that that concludes our work today, so we are adjourned.